You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
With infinite complacence, people went to and fro the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Well, the first one, I didn't know how to classify it or even really think about it. I guess I was probably about 13 years old at the time. It was when I was growing up, local city in Florida, just a typical suburban neighborhood, nothing exciting about it at all. It was a really small house. We were the only family that ever lived in it. My parents bought it new probably in 1972 or 73, I think. So no background history or anything, but to kind of give you a setup, it happened at night. My bedroom in that house, I had bunk beds. They weren't in parallel to one another. It was kind of like the top one was perpendicular to the bottom one. So while I was laying on the bottom one, my head was underneath the top bed. My feet would have been out in the open, if that makes sense. This all kind of tie in when I get to the description of what happened. And off my left side, my bed was against the wall, and to my left was a window that just faced the backyard of our house. And to my right, underneath the rest of the top portion of the bed, the top bunk, was a desk and some little wooden cubbies that I put some books in and stuff. And past the foot of my bed was just a little bit of open space and a desk. I don't remember anything up, the day prior. It was just a normal day, nothing unusual at all. So I went to bed that night, and just all of a sudden the night I woke up completely out of a normal deep sleep, laying there in bed, and the room is dark, but there's enough light come through the window. I think there was a street light or something that was kind of at the four corners of the four houses, mine included. So there's always a little bit of light coming through. It was dark, but I could still kind of see relatively well, all considering. And I woke up, and I didn't know why that I woke up. I didn't hear anything, and there wasn't anything in my room that made any noise to wake me up. And it was just weird that I woke up so quickly. So I'm laying there, I'm just kind of looking around just with my eyes. I'm not moving. And from the top bunk, it's just a figure. A solid, just pure black figure, just for lack of a better word, floated down from my top bunk. There was a ladder that went up to the top bunk right next to me to my right, but it didn't jump down. It wasn't like it fell, and it definitely didn't walk down. It just kind of floated down at a really controlled rate and landed to my right on the floor, just maybe 3 or 4 feet to my right. And slowly walked down to the foot of my bed, and then went right and stood at the very foot of my bed, and then turned to stare at me. Well, obviously, I, at this point, I'm just absolutely terrified. I don't know what this thing is. And I go sit up and I can't move. I am completely paralyzed. I can't move at all. And just the feeling of this thing looking at me, I'm 42 years old now and I've had enough life experiences to have a variety of tense moments in my life, but nothing to this day has ever filled with being as much just pure terror as that, whatever it was, just staring at me. And that it didn't have any features at all. I couldn't see eyes or anything to it. It was just absolutely pure black, but it wasn't like a shadow either. It was well defined. I mean, if you look at something, you can really see the edges of it. But this thing was just completely well defined, but the purest, deepest black color. And it just stared at me. It just stood there. And I tried to scream. I could move my eyes and I was able to open my mouth. Otherwise, I couldn't move. And I tried to scream and call out to my parents, who were in the room right across the hallway from me, and nothing came out. And it was just the weirdest feeling because my mouth was open and I felt like I was screaming, but there was absolutely zero sound came out. At that point, terror intensified even more. And I just didn't know what to think. And this whole thing went on for maybe about a minute, maybe two. It wasn't very long. And then all of a sudden, just like a snap, it was morning. I didn't call back to sleep. I didn't pass out. It's just all of a sudden morning. And it was early in the morning. The light was starting to come in the window. And I'm laying there in the exact same position I was when this thing came down from my top bunk. And at that point, I sat up and I could move. And I'm looking around. Oh, God. And I look up to my top bunk real kind of cautiously. And there's nothing up there. Nothing out of place. Everything was exactly normal. So yeah, that was the first event. For the week after that, I was just kind of like really hesitant to go to sleep at night because I was like, oh my God, is this going to happen to me again? And I didn't know what to think of it. This is early 90s, and the whole alien abduction thing was starting to come out. Or the X-Files, and pop culture-wise, that sort of thing is starting to get big. So I was like, kind of wondering, was it that? But it didn't feel like what people would talk about on TV and the things you hear. And I didn't have any marks. There was nothing. I didn't have any weird dreams about anything after the fact. It didn't feel like an alien abduction, but I didn't know what else to categorize it as until listening to your show, maybe a couple of years ago, I think someone mentioned the sleep paralysis. I never heard of that. And I ended up looking into that and I found a documentary on TV about people who had experienced sleep paralysis. And I was like, oh my God, that's exactly what happened to me. Finally, I kind of had some kind of label to put on it, but just the absolute most terrifying experience I've had in my life.
And David, how tall was that thing?
My dad was about 6 feet tall, and I was probably maybe in eighth grade, I guess maybe 5-something, 5 feet, 5'2", maybe more than that. I'm pretty tall now. I'm 6'2", fully as an adult. If I had to guess, I would say maybe it was about my size. It definitely was not the size of an adult man, that's for sure.
And did you end up telling your parents about this experience?
No, actually, the only people I've ever told about this is my wife and you now. I've never told anybody else about it. I didn't know what to think, and I didn't want to tell my parents because they'd either just kind of blow it off or think I was being kind of weird or something. But no, it's just my wife and then now you right now, the only people I've ever told about.
These kinds of experiences, the true one-offs, and I've had my own, and you're kind of going, is this going to become a regular thing? I mean, it's, as I've said a million times, so different when it's in your own home, especially your bedroom, it's a place to sleep and get some rest and not be worried. So you said that this was essentially a brand new home when you guys moved in.
No, we were the only people that ever been there. So there was definitely no occasion for anything to happen. Yeah, no history, no nothing. Nothing weird. There was my parents were really decent people. There was never any abuse or any weirdness on that scale. Nothing ever untoward ever happened in the house. It was, I can't think of any reason why there would be anything on the house.
And you had never heard during your time living there of them mentioning anything strange at all for them on their side having an experience. Okay.
No, not at all. My parents have never said anything like this. None of the other kids in the neighborhood or anybody ever talked about that kind of thing or anything even remotely similar. And it's the only time it's ever happened to me. I know a lot of people that have sleep paralysis say that, it happens repeatedly. That's the one and only time. Thank God I don't want that on a recurring basis, to be sure.
No.
But it was like I said, it was the most terrifying thing I've ever happened in my life. It's that feeling of absolute, complete powerlessness, of just laying there and just not being able to move and run away or even call out for help. It was just absolutely terrifying.
You know, when these things show up, it's kind of like the dog man in the cryptid world. They just don't care if you see them. They almost sometimes seem like they're here to puff up in your face and make you feel this terror. And they want to know that they know that they're there and vice versa. And it seems like a lot of times these shadow figures, whatever you want to classify them as, they are the same in that they just, they'll come down and they'll, like you said, it's standing at the end of your bed and you could almost essentially tell that it was staring at you.
And it just stood there. It didn't make any moves. It didn't gesture with its arms or move up and down or anything. It just walked real slowly after it alighted on the floor, just walked down there and turned and just stared at me. And just, I couldn't, there were no features to it at all. It was just completely normal humanoid figure, and that's part of what made me not really, back then you would think of the typical gray alien, big head, really skinny body. It didn't look that, the outline of it didn't look like it. This looked very, very normal as far as human proportions go. I didn't see any hair or anything. It didn't have any features like that on its head. The head was just almost as if it would have been bald, I guess. But it was just complete blackness, but I could feel it looking at me. I mean, I knew it was just standing there looking at me, but it was almost like there was a feeling to it as well. And that just added to this, the fear that I was experiencing. Yeah, but and then the poof like that, it was morning. And that was the weirdest part too, is that I didn't feel like I woke up in the morning. It was just all of a sudden it's there, and just in an instant, I was laying in the same spot with my eyes open, like I had not moved, and it's just daytime. And then if I had to guess, I would say it's 3 in the morning or something like that. And then poof, several hours later, it's morning. Strangest thing.
Yeah, I'm a big no on that kind of stuff happening in the home, in your bedroom, of course, waking up to something like that. It's one thing to see them in the middle of the day in the woods, but another one in the house. So I'm very happy to hear that this is the one and only time.
Yeah, me too. I'll take a big pass on it.
Yeah.
I need that in my life. That's not for me. Yeah.
Well, yeah, let's talk about the next incident. I won't tease as to what this is, but it's a completely different subject, everybody. So, let's hear about this one.
So, professionally, I work for the Federal Aviation Administration as an aircraft controller. I've been doing that for 20 years now. And my second duty station was Savannah, Georgia. We moved there in 2010. And after a little over a year there, we bought a house. A new neighborhood, a little town called Tooler, Georgia, just immediately west of the airport there in Savannah, just across Interstate 95. Nice little town. It's nothing unusual about it at all. But our neighborhood, we were at the very, very end of the neighborhood. They were eventually going to build more, another phase, and they did, but after we sold the house and left eventually. And if you think about it, our house faced north, And directly behind our house was a woods and marshland for maybe about 3/4 of a mile, a mile until you got to a major road called Jimmy Gloat Parkway that would go out to the west and ended up connecting to another part of Savannah. To our west of our house was woods for a very, very long time. I mean, sure, you could have walked and walked and walked for days and woods. There was nothing to the west of us. And right at the end of our street there at the west, there was a little gravel pit, I guess you would call it, just kind of where the construction company had left bare gravel, concrete, you know, that they dumped after they, you know, were pouring a foundation on some of their home and then the roads and building. And then just, you know, it was small, maybe the diameter of this little gravel pit was maybe 50 feet. And then beyond that is where the woods started. And directly across the street from us was our neighbor's house. We kind of saw the side of their house. Their front faced a different street. And then just houses and houses all the way to the right. So part of my job, I work a lot of shift work so that I get up at all hours of the time. Every day of the week, I have a shift that I work. And this particular morning, I was getting up and going to work, and it's pitch black out. It's maybe 4:35 in the morning, something like that. And I went to just drop the mail in my mailbox out by the street. And so I go out there, and I haven't unlocked my truck yet or anything. I'm just walking the mailbox, and I put my mail in there. And as I'm kind of flipping out the little flag for the mailbox, I hear behind me a very distinct sound of a rock being thrown, which, you know, there's been plenty of times in life, you know, that kind of skittering sound as a rock or something hits the road and kind of bounces along. And so I heard that sound right behind me on the street. I'm like, well, that's really weird. And I can turn around and I look towards the wood line. And as I'm looking, I hear another larger rock, you know, not big, but definitely sounded bigger than first. And I say that because it kind of landed in the grass somewhere behind my neighbor's yard. Not spotted grass, just kind of just weeds and just wild grass. And I kind of heard a little bump. And I'm like, okay, that's really weird now. And then maybe 15 or 20 seconds after that, another rock landed in the street, kind of just across from me and getting down the road a little bit. And at that point, I'm like, all right, I'm out. And I got in my truck and I drove the hell to work and got out of there as fast as I could. And that was the entire incident with that. And there's a little bit more I can go into about some other stuff here in a second that I don't know if it's related or not, but I think it's very strange. If you have any questions about where we're at so far.
No, go right ahead. Yeah.
Okay. So that happened. And I would go running a lot in the mornings. And I'm not afraid of the woods at all. I've been in the woods a lot over my lifetime, just like came all for many years, camping and night land nav in college. And, you know, they just give you a compass and a red light flashlight and a map and drop you in the woods and say, you know, all right, find your way out. So I'm very comfortable with woods and darkness both. Neither one bother me. But I would go running sometimes 3 or 4 in the morning just before I had to get up for an early shift, several miles. And there were always 2 spots when I would run. As I would go east along the road houses on towards the end of it before I got to kind of a major through road in town, there was a school off to my left and woods to my right. And every time I would run by that patch of woods, I would just get the eeriest feeling, just this really crazy feeling, just dread, for lack of a better word. And then as I would, you know, make no delay, try to get past that area, and then I would make a left and kind of go by the front of the school that was on this major through road. And again, there was another patch of woods on the other side of the street that always just gave me absolute willies. And it was just a weird feeling. And all of those things said, about the same time that this rock throwing incident happened, you go ahead and say that all the stray cats in the neighborhood disappeared. And saying that when we moved into the house, we noticed, and my wife and I are big animal lovers, we've always had cats ourselves. We noticed there were probably about 10 or 12 random cats wandering through the neighborhood. A couple were people's actual pets, they had collars, but most of them were either just strays or ferals. Some of them looked like they were maybe half bred with a bobcat or something, just kind of strange. Just definitely wild cats. And some of them were friendly, some of them would stay away from way far away from me. But there was one little black and white cat, really small little female cat that we kind of was named Oreo, and Oreo would come around and we'd feed her. And then we found out that everybody in the neighborhood was feeding Oreo. So she was living a good life. And then she eventually had kittens in one of our neighbors' garages and they kept kittens. And so we always saw Oreo around almost every day, if not every other day. At one point she got pregnant with kittens again. And by this point, all the cats were around. We kind of had, you know, there was a big orange one and a big black one. It was real scruffy looking. Then we had little names for them. We knew who all these cats were. And about the time that Oreo got pregnant with kittens again, she disappeared for a while. And then one day she came back and we could tell that she was no longer with kittens, but she didn't have them with her either. And she looked kind of sickly a little bit, and definitely thinner than she'd ever been, and she was a little cat to begin with. And that was the last time we saw her. She went away and she was kind of skittish, and she went away and we never saw her again. And we asked some of our neighbors, hey, you know, did animal control put out any scraps or anything? Because at the same time Oreo disappeared, so did all the other cats. Our neighbors like, no. And like, have you seen Oreo? But no, we haven't seen her. And nobody knew what happened to all the cats in the neighborhood. Shortly, or maybe say either shortly after or right around that exact same time, the rock throwing incident. And I always thought that was awfully strange that all the neighborhood cats disappeared when something kind of decided to throw these rocks at me first thing in the morning. I thought about that rock throwing incident over and over because it was just so damn weird. And there weren't really very many teenagers in the neighborhood. The first thing I thought was, well, maybe it's some kid playing a prank or something. But I was like, well, why would they be out in the bushes at the very end of the neighborhood for something 5 in the morning? And I'm like, well, my neighbor's kid, 2 or 3 years old, they're not, most of the kids in the neighborhood were really very young. We had a lot of young military people renting houses in our neighborhood. And they all had really little kids. So there weren't a lot of people who were old enough even to have older kids that maybe might be pranking anything. And it just didn't make any sense. And I don't know, we don't have any monkeys or anything in our neighborhood, so there wasn't any other animal I could think of that would grab or anything and throw it. And I just couldn't piece it together. I never saw anything. I didn't see anything in the woods. I didn't even really hear any rustling in the bushes, but something dancer threw rocks at me 3 times. And they weren't trying to hit me, but they were throwing them in my general direction. They weren't throwing it hard, I wouldn't say, but on the same hand from where I was standing to the wood line was probably 50 to 75 feet. So they threw them a good distance. But it was really unnerving, and I wasn't going to stick around to go poking around the woods and start talking to anything and trying to ask what was going on.
No. No.
Yeah. And don't know what it was. You know, I know there's a lot of Bigfoot stories about them throwing stuff, but I never saw anything. I never saw any evidence, any footprints or anything. No, nothing that would lead me to for sure say that's what it was, but something was out there and something threw rocks at me. That's for sure.
Now, these 2 spots that you say you always had this really creepy feeling, did you ever go running during the day by those spots and have the same feeling?
I did run from time to time in the day. Being in the South, I try not to run too late in the day because it gets awful hot. But from time to time, I would. And yeah, I never liked running by those places. I don't know if that was just because in the first couple times that it happened, it kind of developed a thing with me that I never liked them. I didn't even like driving by them, to be quite honest. But yeah, there always was a vibe.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
And you said this was back in like 2013, 2014. So you said there was a whole lot of woods back there. Do you know around how much of that swath of woods, what that size would be back then?
Oh God, no, it's huge. The stuff behind us was all low-lying woods and marshland. I mean, it was like a thin, it's hundreds and hundreds of acres just behind us. And to the west, I mean, it was, for lack of a better term, it was almost infinite woods to our west.
Okay.
And the closest thing to anything to our west was a racetrack called Roebling Roads. That's way, way, way west. Probably a good 12 miles at least out in an area called Effingham and Bloomingdale in the area. But even that, it wasn't like it exactly a straight shot. I mean, if you just walked perfectly in a straight line from our house, you wouldn't exactly hit it. But beyond that, I mean, there wasn't much. Immediately west of us in the woods, there were some trails. And my wife and I, it was somebody's private property, and we rode our bikes back there from time to time. We could go north of us to another road. It was called Highland Avenue, and we got to the end of that. It was kind of like a cell phone tower. And just past that, you get to the entrance to the person's property, and I had a little typical kind of metal tube gates, and we just pop the gate and go ride. And then the strange thing about back there was there were these really, probably four, I think, that we found, really big deer stands. And they were nothing that you'd buy in a store. They were made out of lumber. Really, I mean, it must have taken somebody a couple of days just to build one of these things. They had these big pylons just buried in the ground with concrete foundations, and they had shingled roofs on these things. You could easily fit two or three adults in one of these deer stands. We went in a couple of them just because we were curious. And then out from these deer stands, they had cleared land, just really roughly with some kind of bulldozer or something, just like shooting lanes. I'm assuming they just put deer corn or something out of the end. They would just sit there and just wait for them to pop up in the shooting lane. But there were at least four of these that we found. And in another spot, there was a little lake off to the far side of the lake from where you would pop out on the trail. There was almost like a little camouflage wood bunker. It wasn't a tree stand, but it was definitely something somebody was using for hunting. But it was tan camouflage and even had some camouflage netting on top of it. And definitely, you can see it because the paint that they used wasn't really great colors. It wasn't supposed natural green that they were using on it, but still they were making some kind of trying to seal it a little bit. It was pretty elaborate hunting devices out there, these stands. I mean, I've never seen a deer stand that sturdily built. These things were huge. I mean, where you were sitting was probably a good 15 feet up in the air, and very sturdily built, which I always thought was very strange.
Yeah, what are they thinking to attach to those, like 50 cals? I mean, what do they need those so large for?
You know, definitely put a Barrett on that thing.
Man.
Stability.
That's interesting.
In retrospect, I was like, wow, what were they hunting out there?
Right.
I don't know. But I mean, it's long shooting lanes they'd set up for these things. And I'm like, wow, this is interesting. It's very, very, really weird out there, and all of a sudden you find a giant, really sturdily built shooting stand up in the middle of the woods off a trail. It was very odd.
Well, that's a cool part to the story then. That kind of also maybe ties some things in, right? The huge swath of lands around there, it sounds like something that was very adept at moving around in such terrain, because you said that it was very marshy too, because it sounds like if you're not something that's built for business out in an area like that, it wouldn't be the easiest stuff to move through, right, in some parts.
Oh, yeah, it was definitely a dense wood, the woods out here in the south. I grew up in Florida, but my family's all from Georgia and Kentucky, so I've lived all throughout the south. I live in South Carolina and Georgia. professionally, and the woods are always very thick, lots of low scrub, palmettos. They're not easy to get through if you get off the trail, and you're definitely going to get cut up and banged up pretty good with some of the plants we have out here. There's a lot of thorns on them, and you know, the palms are really sharp on the edges. It's very, very dense woodland, and then some of it, like I said, was definitely very low and very marshy, especially if we got a lot of rain. Definitely flood out some of the woods and stuff, so it's definitely a very tough terrain.
And have you ever, since then, and if you've been into this stuff or, you know, researched it at all, and it always takes someone actually reporting it for there to be a report, of course, but did you ever come across any actual sightings in that area right there?
No, not in the area, but where we were at was all very new development. Gulfstream Aviation is based in Savannah, and there's a lot of military around there, and little town Pooler has really blown up, about really just exploding development-wise right when we moved there in 2010. So all those neighborhoods we were at all just starting to get built. Maybe they started, you know, within 5 years prior to us moving there, probably. So previous to that, all of that land was all woodland. I don't know if anybody owned it individually or if it was county land, I don't know. But all those neighborhoods and that, all very, very new. So I tried looking to see if anybody had ever had any Sasquatch reports or anything like that in the area, and I didn't find anything.
Yeah, I'd imagine. I mean, it's just what we do as human beings. We just end up taking over everything. I'm sure that even now, there's a whole lot less woods in that area, but maybe the native creatures, animals, whatever you want to label them as, in the area were just pretty ticked off, because I would assume that the construction maybe in some parts of that area and the neighborhoods were probably just continual in a way, the construction.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I said eventually, right about the time we were selling the house, we knew we were going to be moving to Florida, so we decided to sell the house and just have that money in the bank fully moved. They just started clearing out some of the land to the west of us, and they started taking the road right as we were selling the house and leaving. Since then, our neighborhood, our old neighborhood, has been built up, and it's pretty much finished now, but they're still building. So, yeah, I wouldn't doubt it if they were upset with all the construction and whatever might be out there, because there was definitely plenty of it. There was no lack of noise and construction vehicles and cutting down trees and all that kind of stuff was going on pretty much daily.
The last thing about this, David, that kind of stuck out to me was the fact that the two creepy spots were right around the school. And, you know, you've heard stories of them being around schools and, you know, kids seeing them, watching them, or a teacher seeing, you know, something large in the woods. And they do like to watch people, and it seems, especially kids, however people want to think about what that means. Either way, kind of creepy, of course. But anyway, that sticks out to me, the fact that the two creepy spots were around the school. I would imagine that if you're a Bigfoot in the area and there is a school to watch and the kids running around and screaming and playing, and you're wondering what in the hell are these little guys doing, maybe that has something to do with it. You know, those two creepy points being right around that school, is there, you know, you're essentially running right through their live theater.
You know, I had not even thought about that. That's a really good point. No, I never considered that, but I mean, it was definitely a full school. The school was built about the same time as the neighborhood, and it was at capacity. I mean, actually, they were starting to add portable classrooms and everything behind it because there were so many kids there. So they would have had something to watch, that's for sure.
Was it an elementary school or a middle school?
It was like an elementary and middle school.
Ah, so, okay. So it was little kids. See, in my brain, I just automatically labeled it that, and I shouldn't have done that, because I was like, oh, you know what? It could have been a high school. They wouldn't have been running around on the playground in that case.
Little kids, yeah.
Yeah, because...
And now that I think about it, actually the athletic fields and like the playground equipment was closest to the road that was close to the woods, that kind of creepy spot of the woods that I was talking about. So if you wanted to watch children, that would have been actually the perfect spot, because that's where they were all running around.
Yeah, that's creep factor 10, yeah, you know, with them deciding they want to watch that. That's very strange. Because if you think of you're going running around, you know, 4:30, 5 o'clock, whatever, in the morning, and then just a few hours or a couple hours later, there would have been kids there. So maybe they were just setting up for the day, grabbing the old popcorn, you know?
Yeah. Well, that makes it even worse now.
It does, doesn't it? There's something about how they're interested in women and children. Sometimes they're like, why? You know, is it for just curiosity or is it for bad reasons? You know? But I mean, the four huge deer stands, that's pretty cool. I don't think I've ever quite heard anybody say that they've, you know, come across stands with big old pylons and you're going, what in the hell are you hunting out here on these things?
These things were so substantial that if you go on Google Earth and you go back to around like the 2012 time frame and look at those woods before they leveled it all and started making measurements out of it, you can pick out a couple of these deer stands
on
Google Earth from satellite. They were that substantial. If I went on there, I still have them marked on my Google Earth on my PC. I can go back and just do a little time function and go back to before they leveled it. And you can see these things on Google Earth. They're that substantial.
That's extremely strange.
Oh, yeah.
Things that make you go, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we're going to switch gears again, completely, totally, and utterly, and full stop here to event number 3.
Yeah, like I said earlier, professionally, I work as an aircraft controller for the Federal Aviation Administration. I've been doing that for 20 years now. Savannah was the second duty station I worked at. I was there for 6 years. It's a interesting airport. The FAA classifies their facilities between level 4 and level 12, level 4 being the simplest and least complex and least busy, so level 12 would be in places like Chicago or Atlanta. Savannah was level 8, a lot of military traffic, a ton of military, both on the airport and from the surrounding places, Marine Corps Air Station Beaufort, and all their fighter units are up there, just northeast of us away is an Army airfield. Lots of commercial flights for a medium-sized airport. The terminal wasn't huge, but we had about 15 different destinations. So there was quite a bit going on. Gulfstream, again, flew quite a bit, did a lot of test flights and maintenance. So it was not busy, but it was kind of complicated and an unusual operation. Working at Savannah, again, I had been in the FAA probably 12 or 13 years when this happened. It was around 2015, 2016. I can look on that time frame just because I knew it was after we sold our house, but before I knew we were in the planning process of coming back home to Florida to get back where we're at now. So one day I was in the TRACON and there was not a supervisor present at the time. So we do what's called a controller in charge. One of the aircraft controllers who's properly rated is responsible for the whole of the operation and just kind of performs supervisory duties until somebody from management comes back. So I was just sitting behind the desk in what we call the TRACON. It's the radar room. Savannah had both a control tower and a radar room. And so I was down there, and we just had a couple of guys, a couple of radar scopes, just doing normal everyday stuff, and nothing much going on. Then all of a sudden, the guy working one of the sectors says, "Hey, man, I need you to come over here, man. I'm getting, this is weird." And I'm like, "What?" And he automatically, we normally wear headsets, but you can put it in a loudspeaker. So he just automatically kind of reached over and put it in a loudspeaker. And he says to this pilot, he's talking to a guy flying some kind of Learjet or Gulfstream or something that was coming in. So we own one of those kind of jets, corporate jet. And the guy's like, "Yeah, it's just off to our left and we can see it clear as day." And I'm like, "Well, what's he talking about?" So he's like, "Hey, man," he talks to him. He says, "Hey, describe it to me again, what you see." He's like, "Well, it's a silver orb." And I'm standing there like, "Okay." And I was like, "Hey, man, just ask him some more. Tell him to describe it more." And he's like, "Okay, well, is it a drone? Is it a UAV?" Because at the time, we were having some issues with UAVs. This is when those were first new and a lot of close calls with airplanes. So we were kind of thinking, well, maybe it's that. And he's like, "No." He's like, "It's definitely not a drone." He's like, it's big enough that I can see it's just exactly spherical. It's just a silver orb." And the guy just said again. And so the controller asked him, he said, "Well, can you see any lights? Is it like glowing? And he's like, no, it's not lights. He's like, it's just silver, like it's just reflective, like it's reflecting the sunlight off of it. So, okay. And so at the time, this aircraft is on final for runway 28 at Savannah International. And I think the plane was maybe between a 5 and a 10 mile final during the period, you know, this brief period when we're talking to him. Well, he had another aircraft that was inbound that he was vectoring to follow this guy that was south of his position. And as we're talking to this guy, eventually he says, okay, well, thank you. Contact tower. And he switches him to the control tower. Well, right after that, this other pilot is like, hey, I see exactly what that other guy was talking about. And this is another, you know, corporate jet pilot of some time. I don't remember the call sign. So he's like, okay, well, tell me what you're seeing. And this guy was kind of directly due south of basically where the pilot had been, maybe by a few miles. And this object apparently was kind of south of the final for runway 28, but just north of where this other aircraft was. So kind of between where the two aircraft had been. And he's like, yeah, I see it too. And it's a silver orb. And so he's like, well, can you tell how big it is? He's like, well, I can't really put a size on it, but he's like, it's definitely big enough that I can see it without any difficulty. And it's definitely like a bright metallic shiny orb. He's like, it's perfectly spherical. And I definitely see it. It's just hovering there. It's just sitting there. And he's like, okay. And so eventually he vectors his plane onto the final. And so he's now kind of going back towards the airport again to line up with the runway on previous aircraft. And he's like, well, do you still see it? He's like, oh, yeah. He's like, I see it. It's off our left side now. And, bright as can be. He's like, I have no problem seeing it. I'm like, okay, well, do you see anything around it? And he's asking this guy, you know, some real common sense questions. And he's like, it's just hanging out there, man. He was kind of matter of fact. He's like, it's just a silver orb just hovering there. And he's like, okay. And he's contact tower. And he kind of turns around to me. He's like, are you going to report this? And I'm like, I don't know. So I went back to the desk and sat down. And I'm thinking every time anything happens, we have to make a log entry. And there is a phone number. I don't know what it is because nobody ever uses it in one of our orders where you can tell a pie, hey, you can call this number if you want to report a UFO. We didn't, neither of these guys, we did ask them if they wanted to report anything. Because there's always a stigma that you're going to get called up by the flight surgeon or something, and they're going to pull your medical if they think you've lost your mind or something, if they think you're crazy or drinking or otherwise under the influence of some kind of substance. So nobody really wants the flight surgeon involved if it starts to go that route, if they're questioning you. And we're under the same kind of restrictions as controllers. We also have that medical requirement that nobody wants to play with, because you lose your medical, you lose your job. So I'm sitting back there at the computer with my daily log open, thinking, man, do I want to report this or not? I'm just thinking, and I'm like, you know what? No, I am definitely not putting this in the log. I don't want any more questions about this. Because if it had been one guy, it might have been okay. You know, it's just a one-off thing. The fact that two pilots, both corporate pilots, it means they probably had a fair amount of flight time each. They weren't inexperienced new pilots or anything. They both reported this same time, exactly same description. They sounded completely sincere on the radio frequency. It was definitely, they were being very honest about what they were seeing, and it was unusual. They were both seeing it in the exact same spot. It wasn't moving. There was no real physical characteristic to it, and the lights, no rotors, no jets, nothing hanging off of it, just perfect silver shiny sphere. And I would say, based on what they reported, the altitude of the thing was maybe around 1,000 to 1,500 feet, because both these airplanes were operating between about 1,500 and 2,000 feet at the time we were talking to them, and they both indicated that it was a little bit lower than their altitude, and maybe about 2.5 to 3 miles away from them. And again, they could see it without any problem. It was big enough and shiny enough that they could see it. After that, nobody else reported it. We asked a couple of airplanes that came in later, and nobody saw anything after those two. We didn't get any other reports from anywhere, no phone calls or anything. Sometimes you get weird phone calls. People see a plane and they think it's something else. And it's some operation that we do know about. Again, with all the military activity we had there, a lot of times at night over the firing ranges that were southwest of Savannah, that planes would drop a lot of flares, AC-130 gunships and things like that would be out there. They especially dropped flares a lot, and you'd sometimes get phone calls about that. And easily explainable things that we knew were happening. If someone called, you, oh yeah, it's not a UFO, you know, it's not anything weird, it's not an invasion, it's just the military's out there doing military things again. And this time, there was no explanation, there wasn't anything that was supposed to be happening there. The location where it was on the final, or just south of the final runway 28, there's not really a whole lot going on. It might have been in some faintly suburban parts of the city of Savannah, not far from the Savannah River, and probably a little bit east or east southeast at the port of Savannah. Savannah has a really big port. A lot of people don't know it's one of the bigger ports in the country. So it was kind of vicinity or maybe just east port, but nothing really unusual about that location. But definitely weird. I decided not to report that. I didn't put a log entry in. When the supervisor came in to relieve me, I didn't tell him a word about it. And neither did the other controller. We just decided to keep it to ourselves. And the third controller in the room didn't really want to have any part of it. He's like, that's such y'all's business. I don't want to know. I didn't talk to him. It's y'all's problem. And we moved on with life after that. But I definitely never forget it, because that's the only time in 20 years of air traffic that I've had any kind of report even similar to that. And I didn't see anything, because I was in a dark room with no windows and a bottom of a building. It was a very, very unusual report.
So this UFO number, the UFO hotline number that you guys had essentially at your fingertips, if you called that, would that go to a more local office or local number there in Georgia? Or was that the same number that every tower would have across the United States?
It's the same number for everybody. It's some kind of national UFO reporting network or something like that. And again, it's one of those things that you vaguely know exists, but you never look it up. It's in the back of one of our orders. I don't know if it's the 7110.65, which is our main order that covers rules, or 7210.3, which is basically a facility administration. Those are two big rule books that we use. I don't remember which one it's in. It's in one of the two. It might be in the 0.3. But it's like a literally about one or two lines long. It's like, if somebody reports a UFO, they can contact this number if they want. And that's the long and short of the entire little blurb in the order that we have. But I've never had to issue it. Again, this is the only time I've ever had a report like this. And those guys were both, no, we don't want to report anything.
So you guys in the tower across the board said, yeah, we're just going to act like this didn't happen. I don't blame you a bit. The pilots also, of course, said the same thing. But what if they decided later on to report it and then you guys didn't? And, you know, and in their report, they were like, yes, we called the tower and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Would then that come down on you guys at all later on that you didn't report it and the one of the pilots or both the pilots did?
No, if they were probably going to do that, I mean, with these guys being both aircraft and corporate of some variety, something like Part 135 operators, I recall, they really wouldn't have much of a corporate structure above them, not like an airline anyway, that would care a whole lot, I wouldn't think. And if they did report it, they could do it anonymously and without any fear of any kind of a retribution through a program called ASAP. Mm-hmm. And it's a safety action program or something like that, I think is what that means. But it's just anonymous reporting anything that has any safety incident or problem that's systemic that you want to report, but not face any possible harassment or anything. And just to get the problem addressed, you can go through that and it's anonymous and it won't pin anybody down. It won't get anybody in trouble. And we have a similar system for us too. So the chances of that coming back on anybody are pretty slim.
Yeah. Anybody working in the capacity of the business of flight, getting your medical pulled is essentially it's the card of death. So I could understand where everybody's just kind of like, you know what, we're good. That was cool, but let's just we don't need to report this at all.
Yeah, everybody's always paranoid about their medical, so we always try to make sure that we do everything possible to make sure we keep that medical until you at least get your good time, and they can't take away your retirement and everything. was a very unusual one. Again, I've seen all kinds of stuff. I've worked just about every kind of airplane that could possibly fly through airspace the United States, from little Cessnas all the way up to B-52s and stealth bombers and everything in between. Talked to it all. The only other time I've ever heard anything remotely similar to this oddness of this level was a guy I worked with at Savannah, and I didn't tell him about this, but he used to work when he was in the Air Force at Nellis Air Force Base and was a controller there. And he said at night, sometimes they go out, you know, just out of town a little bit and do camping or something, and they'd see weird things in, you know, the direction of, you know, the Area 51 ranges and things flying around. It didn't make any sense to them. That was the only other person I've ever talked to that had any kind of remotely similar kind of experience. And again, they were the same. They're like, we're not telling anybody. It's about this. We're keeping it to ourselves, at least as far as official work stuff goes.
Right. Yeah. It's all fun and games until the higher ups get involved. And then you're like, never mind. Just kidding. I was spinning yarns there. I didn't see a thing. No. And again, these guys reported no movement whatsoever. It was, like they said, it was just kind of hanging out in one spot.
Exactly. It was just hovering. It wasn't moving at all. And even as the second aircraft, it was basically south of it and kind of made a left-hand turn where it would put it east of this object and then eventually north of it as it rolled out on the final for runway 28. So this guy got a pretty good, you know, almost 75% view of all sides of this thing. He saw everything but the west side of it. Stayed in the same spot, didn't move. It wasn't left anything. It wasn't moving or, you know, oscillating or anything. It was just perfectly still, hovering silver orb. No light, no identifying features, nothing.
Also, David, very good point you made about them being corporate pilots. Those guys, a lot of times, they're making pretty darn good money, if not amazing money. And that is because they do have a lot of flight time. So they're, a lot of times they're flying, you know, millionaires and political folks and all of that kind of stuff. So there is a huge difference between that mm-hmm. and, say, right, like a Southwest plane coming in where you might have essentially you can have a brand new pilot. That's kind of where a lot of those guys start, right?
Yeah, oftentimes it can be newer guys too in corporate, but it's more uncommon. A lot of those guys, especially a lot of the ones we talked to at Savannah, just because there's a lot of military aviation in the area, a lot of times guys that leave, you know, the military after flying F-18s for the Marines or whoever and end up transitioning over into corporate aviation because it pays pretty well. And you get way better schedules and stuff if you can find a job doing it. And we had a ton of that kind of stuff coming and going from Savannah. Gulfstream was the biggest. We worked a lot. There was, at any given time, there were anywhere between 50 and 75 Gulfstreams on the airport. And that's a lot of money. And then obviously all the military there. So we had a lot of variety even beyond Gulfstream because there were always corporate people coming for that or for other stuff in Savannah. There's a number of corporations. Facilities in the Savannah area support. So there's all different varieties of companies coming and going. So there's quite a bit of experience flying in the airspace as far as the pilots are concerned. And definitely those corporate guys, on the whole, I feel like generally have a little bit more experience and come from some kind of background
mm-hmm.
prior to them doing corporate aviation. So they bring with them a lot of experience physically.
Yeah, so for them to even bring it up as something strange is poignant.
Yeah, and especially, you know, I think not more so than the civilian guys, which they would know too. You get used to, I also have my pilot's license, but I mostly just fly right seat with a friend of mine. But I try to get up whenever I can. I've been in airplane cockpits since I was 18 years old, off and on. And I'm not any kind of pilot, but I have pretty good eyes and I can see things and pick things up. And you know what you're looking for flying any variety, little one or big one. You have an idea of what you're going to see. And then when you see something that's just that far out of the ordinary that it really just stumps you, that you can only just describe it physically. They didn't try to even attend any kind of, well, it might be this airplane or it might be this helicopter. It was just completely beyond their experience. You could tell from what they were seeing is that they didn't have a clue what it was. And that was what I guess really made it weird is they're like, no, it's not a plane. It's not a UAV. Doesn't have lights. We don't know what this thing is, but it's just a silver sphere. And it was just odd that they just had zero frame of reference for it. That's not usually the case. I mean, a lot of times you're asking guys about if they see something out there because it might be a factor because you're picking something up. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's just a full Cessna down there, low altitude. He's not a factor or whatever. But this time was not like that. It was, and just coming from my own background, having done a little bit of flying, and I'm trying to put myself in that position. That, you know, if I was sitting there looking out the window, what that would look like, you know, visually, just having that background myself, just, that makes it even more odd to me to think about it, because it just doesn't make any sense.
You were probably going, damn, this windowless tower, I want to see it.
Yeah, you know, I wish I had been in the tower at the time. And we didn't call the tower. It had other things going on.
Oh, that's right. You guys were in the radar room, which it had no windows. Yeah, the tower has windows.
Yeah, I've always worked in facilities, Savannah included, that were what we call up-downs. They're both a control tower and an associated radar room, like what we call a TRACON, a terminal radar approach control. All of these facilities I've worked at, we always work both. Sometimes you're in the tower and sometimes you're in the radar room upstairs. And you flip-flop back and forth, you know, maybe once you're in the tower and then after your break, you're down the radar. Kind of random. But this day I was in charge downstairs. At the time I was in charge of the whole facility, but I was stationed in the TRACON. Yeah, it was a odd thing. I was like, I'm damn sure not recording this because I don't want anybody asking any questions. And I don't want to go down the rabbit hole with the federal government for this kind of thing. But fortunately, that was many years ago. And unless somebody was listening anyway and knew about it, then they know about it. And that audio was tucked away somewhere. But it's not, that all that data has long since been deleted.
Now, what about you guys being in TRACON and in the tower? Does the tower hear everything live time that's going on with you guys, or you don't report anything to the tower unless they need to know?
No. Everybody, each position that you work at a facility like Savannah, I think we've had maybe 6 or 7 operating positions that potentially could be staffed more, or I should say less potentially, depending on how much traffic volume we have at any given time. But everybody has their own radio frequency. And if you want to talk to somebody, there's an in-house landline. You can just push the button and talk to them, just immediately be in their ear and talk to them. We didn't call them on the landline, and they wouldn't have heard we were talking unless they were specifically monitoring our position that you're working. And there would be no reason for them. And nobody that was in the tower ever mentioned anything to us. Pilots apparently didn't feel the need or didn't want to mention anything to the control tower after they got done talking to us at the TRACON, the controller down there. So nobody ever said anything. It was just me and the two other guys that were in the radar room at the time. I was the only ones that knew anything about it. I think I remember who the other guy was, and knowing him, he didn't want to be bothered by the government. He didn't want to get involved with that. And he made that knowledge clear to us as we're down there, me and the other controller talking. And
then literally just, it never comes up again.
No, it never came up. I didn't make a log entry. I didn't call anybody higher level than me. I didn't tell my supervisor or any of the other bosses. I just kept it to myself and never got out. Nobody ever said anything. So, yeah, super weird. I couldn't even begin to assume what it was.
This must happen just probably on the daily somewhere, right? I mean, these kinds of conversations where you're like, well, that was weird. Okay, on with life. We're not, no one needs to know about this ever.
Yeah. The only even close to weird thing I've even had, and it's not even really related, but just a few months ago, I was working the midnight shift here where I'm at now. Just me, I'm all by myself. I've got everything all combined up in the control tower because there's no traffic, and I'm just kind of sitting with my feet kicked up, just sitting there doing nothing, listening to the radio. All of a sudden, out where I work now is right by the ocean, just a couple miles from the ocean, and out of the water, and there was no weather. It was just a nice, clear night, nothing going on where I was at or over the ocean. There was a bright flash of light out of the water, way out. It seemed like it was really far out of the ocean. And as soon as that happened, I could see on my displays that all of my radars went alarm. We have multiple radar sites that we feed off of. They all went alarm. The digital voice recorder has an alarm in the tower. That went to alarm. ILS approach system went into alarm. All these alarms start going off for about 10 or 15 seconds. And then everything went back to normal all of a sudden. And I was like, well, that was damn weird. And again, background-wise, for a few years, I was a national-level subject matter expert with air traffic automation systems. I've done a little bit of work with radar optimization, so I know these systems pretty well, and I know what all the alarms mean. more than a typical controller would. Most controllers don't necessarily know how to use something, but they don't know how it works or how to play with it or anything. But I know a lot more about them than the average controller just because I've been put into those work situations on a volunteer basis. I volunteered to learn more about these things. It was really strange. It almost made me feel like it was some kind of EMP or something like that off the coast. It was far enough away that it didn't fry anything, but it kind of knocked it out of whack for about 10 to 15 seconds. That's the next weirdest thing I've ever had, but it was remotely as strange as that event up in Savannah.
And could you tell at all if the flash of light was more on the water or was it in the sky?
It was not high up in the sky, but I don't know if it was down at sea level either.
Right.
But it certainly was not like way up. I would say, if it makes sense, just to look out the window, the tower right now is maybe, I think, 100 feet up. Just to look straight out, it would appear as if it was just on the horizon. It seemed like it was just straight out on the horizon.
What do you think that even could have been?
I've thought about that. I've actually talked to a couple of my friends about that and told them about that event. I know east of us, there's a lot of warning areas and the Navy plays out there a lot. Usually it's carrier qualifications or some kind of military exercise or something. But it made me wonder if it's some kind of weapon test or if somebody else that wasn't from the United States was messing around with some kind of electromagnetic weapon or something way out under the water. I can't think of anything else. Lightning can interfere with radio communications. We get feedback if there's a thunderstorm and we hear it. And it obviously can, you know, a lightning strike can knock out equipment. But there was no weather near us. There was no lightning, none of that close by. And if lightning's far enough away, you know, if it's beyond 5 or 10 miles, we're really not going to have any impact on our equipment that far away. But I've never seen lightning outside of a direct hit have that kind of impact on equipment. You might lose power because some power gets knocked out and it takes a split second for your backup generators to kick on. But then it's a split second and you might get an alarm just for a second, but this went on 15 seconds. And it was just, I could even look at the scope and tell that all my radar data dropped off briefly. And I was like, okay, that's really weird. But then it went away and everything got back to normal. I didn't have to do anything to reboot any systems or call anybody to get anybody to fix anything. It all just kind of came back after about 10 or 15 seconds. But I've never seen an equipment malfunction quite like that in 20 years working at traffic and worked a number of different kinds of systems and in different environments, but nothing quite like that. The EMP is the closest thing that I can think of, but it must have been pretty far away. The only thing I could think of maybe would be like some kind of meteorite or something exploded in the atmosphere. But again, it didn't seem like it was really high up. Now, I don't know if that kind of thing can cause an electromagnetic pulse, but that's the only other thing I can think of. But it was awful bright and it didn't have like a fiery color. It was like a flash of bluish light is the best way I can describe it.
And what's the protocol if the alarms did not stop on their own? What's your protocol then?
At that point, there's a couple different phone numbers we can call for regional level facilities outside of us to report equipment outages and procedures. You could do it if the equipment did not come back and we had a limited capacity to work air traffic at that point. There are procedures you follow to do that. And hadn't persisted, I would have had to follow those procedures and start making phone calls. Say, hey, I've lost all these variety of equipment. You need to send somebody out to look into it and fix it. One of the local maintenance guys would have to come out in the middle of the night, try and get things back up. And until that point, you know, if it persisted, you know, other neighboring air traffic facilities would have to pick up some of our airspace. And I would have to use, we have a portable radios we can use in an extreme emergency and tune in our frequencies and use those, assuming that they weren't knocked out. And if potentially, you know, if it was so bad that everything was out permanently, you know, for the foreseeable future, we just have to shut down and the air traffic within the vicinity of the airport would be uncontrolled. And that's the way most airports are. There's, I think, 15,000 different airfields of various kinds in the United States, and there's about 650 control towers. So the majority of places where airplanes or helicopters can go are uncontrolled, and they have their own rules to discuss amongst themselves who's going to do what. That would essentially be what would happen at our facility at that point. The planes would just have to kind of talk to themselves. Fortunately, this was, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning, so there was literally nobody flying at the airport or through my airspace, completely dead. And no one else, on the other side, it's also unfortunate, there's no one else around to verify what I saw.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I'm sure maybe somebody saw it, but how in the world would you be able to get in touch with those people, even at that time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you know, even at that time of night, there's not really an arrival going into the major airport close by, or literally was nobody.
Yeah, midnight's pretty late.
Altitude above my airspace. So somebody else, if they were close by, would have probably been far enough away that it didn't impact them. And if it did, it was very momentary.
So it would be treated as an equipment malfunction. And then if the alarms didn't stop and then you had to get someone else involved, then you probably would have had to say, would you have said what you saw prior to that happening?
I mean, I could have just said, I don't know what happened. Everything all of a sudden just started going into alarm. But I think I would have probably said there was something out over the water that caused this. Because, I mean, it could have legitimately been some kind of military something going on out there.
Right.
And this was an unexpected consequence of doing, assuming that's what it was. You know, that's the best guess I can give. It was some kind of military something out there. And that was the result of whatever they were doing, with some kind of disruption very briefly of our equipment.
And then you're like, oh, and I forgot I had 5 hours of missing time after that. No.
Fortunately, no.
Yes, very fortunately, no.
No return of any shadow people or
yeah.
anything, so that was good.
Well, very enjoyable encounters. I appreciate you getting in touch and being willing to chat about these, especially since it sounds like, especially with your job, I mean, you can't really go out and talk to folks about this kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's nice to kind of share these things. Like I said, that first instance is just my wife and you that I've ever told. The other one I've told to a couple of people, and either they just kind of look at me funny or like my uncle, it just terrified him. I told him he's in sleep for 2 days. Stuff throwing stuff at you from the woods.
Yeah.
And the one about the orbs, I have told my wife and maybe my dad, and that's about the only people I've ever told about that. So it's kind of nice to talk about this stuff, because it's just weird. You know, you go through life day to day to day, and I'm not one of these people that has all these experiences all the time. That's it. 42 years is the weirdest possible things I can think of that ever happened to me that I just cannot really explain. You know, I have no real, you know, I try to be logical about stuff. I have two science degrees. I kind of think about things from a really logical framework and standpoint, and I don't have really any good explanations other than things you hear people talking about that are, I guess scientifically you'd say, are not proven yet. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, and it's tough when the stigma is there. Like you said, you get the looks and, you know, and the looks when you're working for the FAA, you don't want those looks. You avoid those at all costs. It's bad enough when you don't have
Absolutely.
To worry about getting
yeah.
medical pulled. So that's an entirely different ball of wax with all of you guys in that field. So I completely understand where you're coming from. Thank you so much for getting in touch and being willing, of course, to come on and record with me.
Absolutely. It was great talking to you.
Well, I'm so-and-so. I was given this name by my parents. I've been to such and such a college. I've done these things in my profession. I produce a little fire. The Buddha says, forget it. That's not true. That's some story. That's all gone. That's all past. I want to see the real you are now. Well, nobody knows who that is. Because we don't know ourselves except through listening to our echoes. And consulting our memories. But then there's a real you, and that again leads us back to this question. Who are you? That is the real you. We shall see how they play with this exam. By the koans, to get you to come out of your shell and find out who you really are.
quite divided on this. They will say, no, we don't believe literally in reincarnation. That after your funeral, you know, you will suddenly become somebody different, living somewhere else. They will say, reincarnation means this, that if you sitting here now are really convinced that you're the same person who walked in at the door half an hour ago, you'll be reincarnated. If you are liberated, you will understand that you're not. The past doesn't exist. The future doesn't exist. There is only the present. That's the only real you that there is. The Zen master Dogen put it in this way. He said, spring does not become the summer. First there is summer, and then there is spring.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.